This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show here on The Orb, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, I just have one question for you. Are you ready to go on a magic carpet ride with Worf?
Oh, I am. In fact, I've got the music queued up right here, and we're putting in the disc right now. It's a weird-looking disc, though. It's like this
kind of green... like an MD, like a mini disc.
Yeah. It's odd. Anyway, Worf let me hook up the player, and we're really excited, too, because we got our new threads on, and we are pimping in this ride. It's awesome. We're about to go Warp 1.
All right. Warp 1.
That's right. Watch out.
All right. So, yes, today we're going to continue our series about Worf and the connections between Worf and DS9 and TNG. It's Worf's journey to DS9, although at this point in today's discussion, he's already very much on DS9. And we're going to talk about how the Next Generation utilized him in the movie First Contact and what influences his time around Sisko and the others on DS9 may have had on his character as portrayed in this film, as well as how it goes the other way. So, Matthew, this is the first movie that was made after Worf went to DS9, and it's really the only TNG movie that was made when DS9 was really in the thick of things, because Insurrection takes place during the final year of DS9 in 2375 during the Dominion War, but this is in 2373, and this is around the time of In Purgatory's Shadow, and Worf had just really been finding his feet over there on the station. He's now in the command track, and this is pre-Dominion War. The Dominion actually invades the Alpha Quadrant around the time of this movie, a little bit afterwards on the timeline. So what are your first thoughts here on First Contact and Worf?
You know, it's really interesting because this movie does bring Worf in at an interesting point in his life. If I remember correctly, the very first episode of Deep Space Nine that would actually have the uniforms, so you'd actually see the effect of First Contact, was Rapture.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Rapture.
And so before that, though, I mean, you know, Worf has had a major change in his life. One, all the mess with the Klingon Empire has happened, and it's finally done now. But two, you know, he's just gotten together with Jadzia, and they've started their relationship. And so, you know, it's really interesting to see that. And in three, as you mentioned, another huge change for him is the fact that he's not security anymore. He is firmly on the command track now, and that puts him in a very different position. And I think when you're kind of thinking about all of those things and you go into this movie and you start to watch it from Worf's perspective and how he acts in relation to the crew and how they act with him, I mean, you know, that's the meaning of the joke between him and Riker about, you still remember how to fire phasers, you know, that joke is because Riker knows he's not a security officer anymore. You know, he's on the command track. And so, I mean, little things like that. The movie references the fact that Worf is a different person. And I think as you kind of dig in and see his reaction to things and all of that, you can really tell that this character has changed and grown and isn't the same Worf, especially that we saw when we had talked about Generations. I mean, he it really is a different person.
Yeah, most definitely. So talking about that in the Defiant, as the movie goes on, you definitely get this feeling for how Worf has changed. But when we see Worf for the very first time in First Contact, he's on the bridge of the Defiant, and of course we know that he's the commander of the Defiant at this point, so that's no surprise. But the bridge is heavily damaged, and he's preparing to ram the Borg cube. That feels a lot like the old Worf to me. So how did you feel when you first saw Worf in the movie? Did you anticipate at that point that maybe we're going to be seeing some changes in the character, or are they just going to put Worf back into the TNG mold of, you know, let's fire all weapons and let's take them out?
You know, it was interesting. I remember the first time seeing the movie and, you know, Worf comes on screen and it's a big moment and, you know, he's on the Defiant, which is kind of cool. They're really
referencing. Today is a good day to die.
It is a good day to die. And, you know, what I like about that is I think it shows that Worf is making a big command decision. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's nobody he has to ask. He's just making the decision. And the decision is, well, the Defiant isn't going to be able to stop, and it doesn't look like we're going to be able to stop the Borg just by shooting at them. Maybe it's best if we ram them and have that huge antimatter explosion, and that will take care of it. And I kind of think of that as, to me, that's my first indication that Worf is, you know, he's a different type of character. And it's a very Klingon response, too. You're going to go out in a blaze of glory. I mean.
Yeah. Well, see, I always read it more as that, going out in a blaze of glory, just the Klingon response, I can't destroy them, so I'm just going to ram them. I never really felt like Worf thought that he would be able to destroy the Borg cube by ramming them. The Defiant is such a small ship, and you've got this entire fleet battling this cube, and no one can make any headway. And the reason I asked the question in the first place was because my reading of that first scene has always pretty much been that he's going back to his Klingon instinct, which we saw often on The Next Generation, of he's the warrior. It's always better to die in battle, and he's going to just ram the ship. Once he realizes that he can't do anything else, that's sort of the last resort. That's the final thing he's going to do.
Well, and two, I mean, what's got to be going through his head is watching this fleet kind of, you know, just be dissipated. I mean, it's not having a big effect. And I do think that his thought is, okay, this may be the only way to stop them. And it's really all we have left. I mean, as the Defiant, we don't really have another choice. And, you know, Worf is probably one of the last captains there. I mean, if I remember correctly, if you're counting, there's probably four or five other ships there at that moment. And then the Enterprise comes in, you know. So it seems like a lot of ships have already been destroyed. I mean, this has gone terribly wrong.
Yeah, a lot have been destroyed, yeah.
And think about this, too, Worf and the Defiant. You know, we know from Deep Space Nine, Sisko tells us when he brings the Defiant in, the Defiant was meant to be a Borg killer, you know, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean it was meant to be something specifically to stop the Borg. And
yeah, it was designed to fight the Borg.
Right, and it's not having the intended effect, or at least it's not written as having the intended effect. So it is very interesting to kind of actually see it up against the nemesis it was built for, the nemesis. Yeah, I don't know. I like this scene. I think it's kind of cool, and it adds all those different layers about Worf. You know, he's a Klingon, he is part of Starfleet, and at this point, I think he's just trying to do his utmost to make sure that Earth is not destroyed, and doesn't look like he has much of a chance other than to ram, you know, this cube. Luckily, Picard and the Enterprise show up. So
yeah, luckily, because I'm not sure that he would have gotten to ram the cube in the first place.
That's a good question. I mean, unless he, the only thing I can think of is that they would go to warp, and they would ram at warp speed, not just ramming speed, at warp speed, and you know, that would cause the destruction that he's looking for. So
maybe, yeah. Although I think if we get into the science of it, I think at that point they wouldn't actually hit the ship, right? Because they would be creating a warp bubble and warping space. So the way that warp speed is portrayed on Star Trek quite often, that makes sense that we'll just go really fast and hit the cube.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, well,
the way it's portrayed at other times in a more scientific way, maybe that would not happen.
You could, I mean, honestly, you could probably just go at full impulse too, because that's pretty fast. So, I mean, it would still probably have the desired effect. But anyway,
I want to hear Worf give a command sometime, like 1/4 ramming speed. And then someone says, Captain, regulation specifically states that we cannot go at 1/4 ramming speed while we are in orbit of a planet.
Well, and what was kind of cool about that whole scene, too, is just the fact that Jerry Goldsmith brings back his wonderful Klingon theme. And I think it plays so well for the what's happening there, the last stand of a Klingon. And, you know, Worf is doing his duty with the utmost honor. And, you know, he thinks this is the only thing to do, and he's making a command decision. It is kind of weird that nobody else from Deep Space Nine is on the Defiant. It's all these people. Well, it's the one person we've never seen before, but, you know, it's convenience.
Right, exactly. The Klingon theme, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of those things where people like to rag on Star Trek V so often, but the Klingon theme, it's Jerry Goldsmith. It's The Final Frontier. One of the best cues in Star Trek, I think, and it gets reused over and over beyond that.
Well, and it just fit the scene, you know? And it fit, I think, one of the interesting things is he uses it again when Worf arrives on the Enterprise, and Crusher brings him onto the bridge, and she says, I have a patient who is refusing to go to sick bay and demands to come to the bridge, you know. And you hear a refrain of that there, too. And it's very telling because, you know, Worf has a bigger sense of importance about himself. Not that he's full of himself, but he feels more confident in who he is and his place. And I think part of that is because he is on the command track now. And, you know, he's at, I don't know if he's at the same level as Riker at this point, a full commander, but I mean, that's a good question for somebody to answer for me, because right into the orb, let me know if I'm wrong, because I can't remember off the top of my head. But, you know, he is captain of the Defiant. And so, I think there is he has a greater sense of himself and who he is, as we've talked about, the fact that continues on throughout Deep Space Nine. And I think that Klingon theme just kind of works, you know, especially with where we're about to go with Worf anyway on Deep Space Nine, where he's really going to be able to embrace his Klingon heritage through getting to know Martok.
You know, I don't think Worf was ever actually promoted to the rank of commander. He's just referred to as commander all the time because they tend to call lieutenant commanders commanders when they're addressing them. But I think that his rank leveled off at lieutenant commander, even on DS9.
Okay.
But again, maybe we're wrong about that if someone wants to correct us and remind us where the additional promotion happened. But the interesting thing about that is, comparing and contrasting the two captains, Picard and Sisko, I feel like part of that confidence that you're talking about stems from him being around Sisko and now having Sisko as a mentor as opposed to Picard. They're both very confident men, but Picard has a very quiet confidence to him. Sisko is more in your face. He's more aggressive. He's bold. And I think that personality-wise, that matches up with Worf's personality in a way that Picard's confidence doesn't match up with Worf's personality. And so there was never a connection between Worf and Picard as a mentor in that sense. but there is with Sisko. And so even a short time with Sisko on the station helped some of that confidence grow in Worf and bubble up, and then he actually shows that confidence more.
No, I think you're right. And, you know, I think that's where we'll come to when, you know, Worf stands up to Picard and they have that big blowout of a scene where he's saying, look, the wisest thing to do is to make sure that we succeed in our mission is to blow up the Enterprise. And, of course, Picard comes right back at him, calling him a coward and all of those kind of things. And they have this huge confrontation. And I think Worf being on the command track and seeing the decisions that Sisko has made, I mean, we talked about some of the things that he's seen Sisko do, especially I think about like the ship and episodes like that, where he's really seeing somebody making big decisions for the fate of the galaxy. I mean, they had just gone through Apocalypse Rising too, where they had snuck on to Kronos to unmask who this changeling was as well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he's somebody who understands the risks now of command a lot more than he used to. And so when he stands up to Picard, yeah, I think there's a lot of Sisko in that.
Well, and I think he's seeing those decisions being made in the field in very difficult situations, not from the safety of the bridge of the Federation flagship, which is where Picard is making his decisions most of the time. And again, that's not to put Picard and Sisko head-to-head trying to compete. They're just in very different situations. You know, the Enterprise is heavily involved in diplomacy within the Federation during peacetime. And Sisko is involved in a lot of situations like the ship where they're crashed on a planet and they're facing off against the Jem'Hadar and the Vorta during, if not a hot war, at least a cold war, but it's really bubbling over now into open conflict.
And it is kind of interesting too, because, you know, the decision that Worf thinks that Picard should make here is probably the wiser decision.
Yeah.
It is the decision that does lead to the Borg being defeated. There is the issue here is that Picard is too close to the situation to have it dealt with. I mean, he can't see what he needs to do because he's too close to the situation with the Borg and this idea of revenge. And it's one of the things I actually really like about the movie is that it's to see that psychological trauma like that he went through doesn't just get healed overnight, no matter how long it's been.
Right.
It's always going to be there. And I think that the battle of wills that happens between those two is really fascinating. And what I love is that for one of the first times we've ever really seen it happen, Picard has to apologize to somebody. You know, he has to come back and say he was wrong to Worf. Not only that, but I think he says he's wrong, but he also says, look, I also think you're the bravest man I've ever known.
And it's the way he says it.
Yeah, and yeah. It's really fantastic because I think he respects Worf and what Worf was saying he should do. And obviously that's what he decides to go with. You know, he's going to stay on the Enterprise. Hopefully he can save Data. But he does exactly what Worf said was the best option. And I think there's a huge, I mean, you can see the huge amount of growth from the Worf who always got told no to the Worf whose plan Picard is actually enacting and had to apologize for not accepting in the first place.
Although Picard did say no to him first.
That is true. That is true. But that was Picard's fault, not Worf's fault. So
right. Well, I don't know if I would always say the others were Worf's fault either. He was just easily dismissed. But this is what I wanted to contrast with my first point when we started the discussion, is that we see Worf wanting to ram the Borg cube and destroy the Defiant. And then here we see him wanting to blow up the Enterprise. And I feel like there's some difference there, because in the heat of battle, the idea of a Klingon taking their ship and just ramming it into another ship, I get. But the idea of a Klingon deciding to activate the self-destruct is sort of a stretch. Like, I feel like previously Worf would not have done that. Previously, in his TNG days, Worf, of course, he was the security chief then, so that is a factor, would want to fight and would believe that as a Klingon, he would be able to assemble his team and retake the ship. But here, Worf is willing to admit that it's a lost cause, that they're not going to be able to retake the ship just through manpower. And the best option is, in a sense, to give up, destroy the ship, get into the escape pods, and go down to the planet and live out your life there. That feels like a very big example of the change that has happened in Worf because of being on the station, because of being on the command track now, being around Sisko, as we just discussed, seeing how decisions are made. The fact that, you know, Sisko makes decisions because he knows when to pick his fights and when to fall back as well. And you see that a bit in Worf here.
Well, and I was thinking this too, you know, Worf has seen some things happen. He's seen Homefront and Paradise Lost happen. He's also been through the Rules of Engagement. Not a great episode, but he's really been growing in his command experience. And I think it's very clear that you see, like you said, he would never have probably advocated for destroying the ship. But here he makes the tactical decision that a commander, that a captain should make, yeah, to say, this is our best chance for success, for saving the future. I mean, the future is on the line, and Worf is willing to do whatever it takes. He was willing to do whatever it took with the Defiant, and he's willing to do whatever it takes with the Enterprise to make sure that the Borg are defeated. And that is somebody who is thinking like a captain, like a Starfleet captain, and using the best of what he is as a Klingon to bring all that out. And I think, again, it's great to see when you think about all the things that Worf has been through on Deep Space Nine in Season 4 and the very beginning of Season 5, how that's affected him. I mean, just think about this, too. He's been through trials and tribulations. He's been around Captain Kirk a little bit. I mean, you know, so this guy is somebody who's been places, you know, and seen things and done things and done some things that Picard hasn't even done, you know. So it's really cool to watch this film and think about the backstory with Deep Space Nine and how much this character has really changed and grown, and it makes you respect that character in a whole new way. And I think it's clearly Worf's best role in one of the TNG films, because it feels in line pretty much with Deep Space Nine. Now, Deep Space Nine will drop the ball. They won't talk about him being away, but That's neither here nor there. This film utilizes Worf in a way that makes absolutely just complete sense, and I think they do the character some real justice.
You forgot to mention that he's also been through looking for Parmok in all the wrong places.
Yes.
I don't know how that ties in, but
well,
it's yet another experience.
Think about this, too. He's in a new relationship. He's a man who's willing to sacrifice the fact he may never see Jadzia again.
Yeah.
And for the betterment of, obviously, the human race. I mean, So that's pretty crazy.
So another thing I wanted to talk about was what I feel is a different kind of honor. And I think that's it, maybe, right there. As a Klingon, he's seeing honor in saving the future, saving Earth. Like, when Klingons, tell me how you feel about this. When you look through, especially TNG, when we get into that style of Klingon, not like the original series Klingons, but there seems to be honor in just sacrificing yourself. Like, it doesn't really matter what it's for. It's just that you're in battle, and for the glory of the battle, if you die fighting, that's honorable. But the stakes behind what Worf's doing here to save the Federation, to save Earth, save humanity, feels like a much more noble reason to die and a different kind of honor than we've seen him pursue in the past. Does that feel that way to you as well?
It does. Every time that Worf is willing to give his life in this film is for the greater good of everything that's going to come next in history, you know, and to make sure that that happens, that is an honorable way to die for something greater than yourself and your own personal honor. And Worf doesn't even seem, you know, when he says today is a good day to die, he's thinking he is going to go die, and but it's not about that kind of like ritualistic Klingon, you know, it's not about that. It's about making sure that the future has a future.
Yeah.
And I think that you're right. It really does a lot for the character. And I think for where we're going to take the Klingons actually in Deep Space Nine, when we really start to talk about honor and those kind of things, when we look at Martok and what he'll teach Worf about honor.
Yeah, I think later in DS9, the Klingons are fighting more for a future. But prior to that, Klingons in general, and even Worf's mindset, had felt like there are situations where they're going to sacrifice themselves and they're excited about it because it's going to be honorable, even though it would make more sense for them to fall back and live to fight another day, right?
Well, and that's where I think it's so interesting is that Worf showing a different kind of honor, he is willing to do that. He's falling back, allowing, and not that there's going to be another battle for him, but he's going to end the battle by falling back, destroying his ship and making sure that the future exists.
Yeah.
And that is un-Klingon, but it's very honorable.
Yeah. Well, we say it's un-Klingon. We mentioned Martok. I can see Martok doing something like that. I think that's where, you know, maybe this is the starting point of changing that view on the part of the Klingons a little bit in the writing that comes after this on DS9. Some of the decisions that we see Worf make in this movie become applied to the Klingon point of view, at least in the case of Martok and some of the others who are fighting under his guidance in the Dominion War. Because I don't know, you can look at it from many different angles. You can look at it from the Klingons ultimately want to destroy the Federation, but they know that they have to keep the Dominion out or else they're never going to have a chance to go after the Federation and the Romulans. And so they're forced to work together. But you can also see it in some people that they are fighting to keep the Dominion out, but they're fighting for the future of the Alpha Quadrant to survive and the structure that they know to survive.
It is really interesting. I like where Deep Space Nine ends up taking the Klingons and really bringing them to a new place and giving them a new chapter by the end. Ending the Gowron regime does a lot for changing the Klingon Empire and where you think it will probably go in the future. And in the same way that Gorkon had such a huge impact, you know, you have these men who, and women, because Azit Bor took over for her father, who come into the Klingon Empire and have a big impact on where it goes. And it's interesting that, you know, Worf, through this kind of different type of honor, is going to be the one who will, he instituted Gowron. He was instrumental in that. He'll institute Martok as well. He's the man behind the throne. So it's crazy. It's so cool to watch that happen.
Well, let's talk about one thing I wanted to bring up. Actually, we moved on from the Defiant earlier when we were talking about that. But one real quick point I wanted to make was that we talk about how the Defiant isn't doing its job very well in this battle, right? Fighting the Borg, because it was designed to fight the Borg. But I feel like the vision of the Defiant was that there would be many, many of these ships attacking Borg cubes together.
Yeah, that's true.
In swarms. But they never built more of them until we get to the big battles at the end of DS9. And apparently they did build a lot of them.
Well, and then the only one I can think of that we actually are on is the Valiant, too, that was lost with all those cadets on it. You know, our favorite episode, so.
So that was just something that, because it is kind of striking in this movie that this ship was made to fight the Borg and then it's just getting its butt handed to it.
Yes, it is.
I don't think it was supposed to fight alone in that case. All right. Well, let's talk about one other Worf point here, the proactive Worf. We've already talked about this along the way, really, in the fact that he's making certain decisions. But you pointed out, as we were talking before the show, how he really doesn't wait. I mean, he's there on the Enterprise. He's part of Picard's crew suddenly, again, for a little while. But he's not really deferring to the captain. He's really making his own decisions. And we see that, you know, in particular when he's out there on the deflector dish and he's got his mechlith at hand at all times, which I have to say, when you're in a pressurized suit, it's probably not a good idea to tuck a blade down your pants, but...
Probably not. But you know what they always say about your mechlith? Never leave home without it.
That's right.
It's like the American Express card for Klingons.
Exactly, the Kronos Express card. But what else do you see in terms of, you know, Worf being more proactive here?
You know, I what I like there in that scene is how Worf takes care of business. And, you know, he does what he needs to do to make sure that the mission is accomplished. And it's, again, you can see it's part of his Klingon-ness, but it's more really that growth, I think, in being in command. And he, like a good, you know, Klingon Boy Scout, he's always prepared. You know, he's prepared for this situation, even though they're climbing on the outside of the hull, for it to go wrong. And to make sure that he has the tools he needs to make sure that this is a successful mission. And, you know,
I think the Klingon Boy Scouts, that needs to be a series of t-shirts.
Oh, man, that would be awesome. It really does. We need Aaron to make us Klingon Boy Scout t-shirts. That's awesome. Their merit badges are big. You know, those are huge baldricks. Goodness.
But you know, that. Yeah, like they've got over their shoulders coming down. Someone's like got like six of them on at one time.
You know, like it's awesome. Oh, gosh.
Oh, man.
But no, I personally, you know, and I love that scene, too, where Worf, he gets his revenge, you know, of, you know, assimilate this. You know, he's just, I know it's kind of cheesy. It's kind of action filmy, but it's totally awesome. And it's totally Worf, too. and I think that's part of the new Worf. You know, he's a little bit more mouthy than he used to be, you know,
a more mouthy Worf.
Yeah, like exactly. You know, but it's a part of him being a little bit more proactive and just a little bit more comfortable in his own skin and who he is and what he's about. And all of that's kind of coming together. And this film's really doing a good job with it. So,
can you remember the crowd reaction in the theater when he said, assimilate this, and shot the Borg and blew them up?
It was big. I remember I saw this film like 6 times in the theater, and I remember each time that line getting a cheer, because it's a big moment. I mean, and it's
a big moment.
It's still, I still want to kind of fist pump every time it happens when I'm watching it at home, because it's just like, yes.
Well, you can be like that hammy guy on the bridge in Generation standing behind Data, and when Data does his fist pump and that guy is like smiling in the background and kind of ruins the scene.
Yeah.
The extra.
Exactly. Yes.
But yeah, I know. That's how I remember it as well. Like, that got a big cheer. Every time I watch the movie now, I feel it's a little more cheesy every time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm okay with it. Like, I think, you know, it is one of those moments that, yes, it's cheesy, but who cares? It's just what it was great about First Contact, and I guess maybe this can kind of lead us into the non-Worf points, but one of the things that's really great about this movie is that it knows how to be serious and how to be fun all at the same time. And that's a really hard thing for Star Trek to do. Star Trek has always had, I think, a difficult time at really not going overboard on the humor. Like, for me, when I watch Star Trek 4 now, personally, it's a little bit much sometimes. The humor's kind of forced at points. But, you know, I think for the most part, all of this humor in this film, along with the seriousness, all blends pretty well, you know? And I can imagine Worf saying something like that, because it's you know, he's letting off steam after what just happened. I mean, he did almost just die, you know, so.
I'm picturing he shoots and the deflector dish with the Borg on it blows up. And then he and Picard both look up and start howling. The Klingon death howl.
That, yeah.
That would be a little bit too much. Yeah, the humor does blend very well in this movie. Everything about this movie just feels like it fits together well, and it's polished. I think this is the Next Generation firing on all cylinders. I disagree a bit on Star Trek IV. I feel like Star Trek IV, that humor works quite well for me because it feels natural. It's evolving out of the situation that they're finding themselves in. Star Trek V is the one for me where I feel like the humor is very forced because it felt like the writers thought, hey, you know, IV, people thought that was funny and that worked out pretty well for us. So let's make a bunch of jokes in this next movie also. And then I felt like that with Insurrection as well. Like,
yeah,
to make that movie funny because they had success in this movie with humor that naturally evolved out of the situation.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I think that the other thing that so works with First Contact, and it's the thing that they try to do every single film after First Contact, was to create a villain that meant something for Picard, because they had this feeling that you can only make a good Star Trek movie if it feels like Star Trek II. For some reason, that's where they came to. And it doesn't make sense, and they'll try it again with Nemesis big time. And what worked so well here is that this was already something built into the show that was personal for Picard, and the way that they kind of expounded on it, it made enough sense so that you could make it work in your mind. You know, the Borg Queen, you know, if you think about, you know, Picard just repressing those memories and not necessarily maybe having the most clear memories of exactly what happened until that's jogged by the right thing.
Yeah.
You can make it work, you know? And so,
That happens in real life. I mean, that's perfectly believable.
Exactly. So I think what works so well here is what they've said for so many years in film. A hero is only as good as their villain, especially when you're going to give them a villain like this. And it not just be kind of more of a personal thing to overcome. Like in Star Trek VI, it's really about the personal villains for the heroes to overcome, you know, like Kirk and the Federation itself to overcome their prejudice against the, you know, that's a different type of villain. Here, it really is a more personal thing, but it just made for a really good, really great act. It's a great action movie, and you know, it gave us First Contact, getting to see that introduction to, you know, Cochrane and all that kind of stuff, and set up Enterprise for us, even though we don't know it. And yeah, it's TNG's best film, bar none. I mean, because two, Chris, I don't know if you'll agree with me, but I feel like when you're watching this movie, you feel like they spent some freaking money on it. Like nothing feels cheap here.
Yeah. No, it's a really well-made movie, and visually, it looks very polished. It feels very cinematic. Of the four TNG movies, this is the one that actually feels like a big Hollywood movie. You know, it is made for the big screen. Generations, as we talked about last time, has its moments where it feels like that, but it also has probably more moments where it feels like a TV episode being shown on the big screen, which I'm fine with. As I said last show, I liked seeing that on the big screen, but compare that to First Contact and it's like night and day, the difference in the production here.
And even in the way I think that it's shot, you know, I think that Frakes brings something just really fresh, you know, and he won't really get that opportunity in Insurrection, but I don't think that's really his fault. I think it's all the constraints that end up getting put on him with the money. But here it's just like they gave him enough money to make a film that looked incredible. I mean, God, the new Enterprise E, the model that ILM built is just phenomenal. It looks so good. So,
and it's interesting that Insurrection takes that step back to feeling like a TV episode again on the big screen, doesn't it? It doesn't have the cinematic feel of First Contact.
No, and I encourage anybody who wants to know more about Insurrection and the backstory to that to check out Literary Treks 90 Through the Brita Filter. We talked about Fade In by Michael Piller, his book about the struggles he had writing Insurrection and where the film was when it started and where it came to. Yeah. And I have to say, if they had kept it the some of the basic ideas that he had in the beginning, this movie would have seemed epic. It would have been big. It would have felt important to Star Trek. And they just weren't comfortable with that. You know, they wanted it to feel more almost disconnected. You know, and that's the thing that's so great about First Contact is that it feels so connected with the Star Trek universe. Mm-hmm. And yet you can just pop in First Contact and watch it anytime and not feel like you did have to watch anything else.
Yeah.
It was kismet. And it just everything came together for that film to make it great.
Well, you get the whole premise of Star Trek. You get the improvements humanity makes in the future. You get where they came from and the strife that led to the changes finally happening in our world. You get the connection to The Next Generation as a series with the best of both worlds. You get the connection to DS9 with Worf. Yeah, like you said, it does feel just completely connected to the universe for sure.
And the other thing I think that really helped is that I think Jerry Goldsmith knocked it out of the park with this soundtrack. You know, the beginning theme is so gorgeous.
Oh, it's one of my absolute favorite pieces of music in all of Star Trek.
It's wonderful, you know, and the everything that he did with the score worked so well. I love this score, and it is one of my favorites to just put on anytime during the day, especially if I'm working, you know, just have in the background. It's so well done. And the expanded score that they put out not too long ago is really wonderful, and it has some nice cues that were missing from the original score, and totally worth it. If you can find it somewhere, I encourage you to look for it. It's tough to find now.
Was it put out by GMP Crescendo?
It was. I think it was a limited run as well. Okay. I'd have to go search for. I have the disc somewhere on my shelf. But it really was. It's a really well done score. Probably the only place you'd find it really these days is on an eBay or something. But well done. So
yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Chris. We mentioned it for a second, but what did you end up thinking about the Enterprise E?
I love the ship. It was an interesting transformation in the way Starfleet was thinking to go from the Enterprise D design. And of course, we have to remember too that these starship designs, let's put ourselves in universe for a minute. Okay. I know it's a TV show and, you know, we're talking about stuff that's not real here, but let's pretend like it's real and we live in that universe.
Chris, your belt buckle is really big right now. You put yourself in that universe with an Admiral's belt buckle. I like it.
That's right. Yes. I didn't have a belt buckle on until I stepped into that universe. And, you might also notice these nice shoulder pads I have now as well, Matthew.
I can't see your head anymore. The shoulder pads are too big.
But let's remember that, you know, developing these starships takes a long time. We're talking about decades. And if I remember off the top of my head, I think the Galaxy class was in development for, it was more than 20 years, I know, in the timeline before it was ever launched. So events around you change. It's kind of like the military today. You know, we develop weapon systems and it takes decades to develop a new fighter jet or a new missile system or whatever. And the threats change along the way. So they develop the Galaxy class, which is obviously developed for peacetime. It's this giant ship that's going to go around, carry diplomats around, carry the flag of the Federation, show how big and prosperous the Federation is to planets that might want to join, and so forth. And then suddenly you get this very streamlined ship, which looks like it was designed by a government and an organization that was feeling threatened from many different sides. And it's designed more to be able to fight and defend than simply to explore. And I thought that was an interesting evolution in the storytelling of Star Trek and what was happening in universe at that point. As far as the design of the ship itself goes, I think it's fantastic looking. My favorite Enterprise is still the original refit of the 1701, but I like the E far, far better than the D for sure.
I am completely there with you. I think it's kind of the best of both worlds, the Enterprise E. You know, it's bigger and more elegant looking than, you know, anything else that they had created, I think, in the 24th century up to this point.
But it's aggressive looking as well, which is striking, right?
And I think it projects strength, you know, and beauty all at the same time. So it has this, you know, imagine this, you know, this is the flagship of the Federation still. So when you come up against it, you see both of those things. And, you know, the Enterprise D, it's hanging right above me here. It's ungainly. It's just, it looks odd. It's got all these weird shapes.
Well, it looks great from some angles, and it looks really bizarre from other angles.
It kind of looks like a bloated whale from others, you know? So one of the things about the E, too, is it really harkened back to that refit in the way that the ship looked from different angles, especially if you looked at it from behind. It had the same kind of profile that refit really did. And so to me, too, it also went with the design that we saw with the Defiant.
Yeah.
So when you were talking about in-universe, the kind of through design, you know, what did we see? We saw Voyager and the Defiant, and then we get the Enterprise E. So the continuity between all of that makes sense. And the Enterprise E is definitely my second favorite Enterprise.
Well, and then you look at things like in the novels, if you look at Ezri Dax's ship, the Aventine, it's clearly an evolution of the Enterprise E design philosophy.
Yes, it is.
And it looks like a shark. It looks even more aggressive than the Enterprise E.
I love that ship. I think it's a really cool, really sleek looking design. And I don't understand why Eagle Moss keeps making all of these like lame ships that are, you know, it's like, give me something like that. You know, I want the Titan and the Aventine, things I actually care about, not a weird, like, I mean, Bajoran Solar Sailor, that's cool, but it's not the same as having like an actual starship design.
Yeah. So, well, they're doing stuff that's on screen. So, but at least they are doing a Titan, right? They got enough signatures.
Yes, I hope that we will definitely see that. And, you know, they are doing the NX-01 refit.
That's exciting.
That's I actually have that on order. So, yeah.
All right. So my final thoughts on the movie itself is just a fantastic movie. This is obviously not a review of First Contact itself, so I'm not going to go into any great depth there. But if you do want more of my thoughts on First Contact, there are two episodes of The Ready Room where we've talked about it. There's The Ready Room 51. That's where we actually talked only about First Contact. So The Ready Room 51. And then there's The Ready Room 149, which is one that I did with the Earl Grey guys, and we did a TNG Films face-off. So we talked about all four of the TNG films there. So that's The Ready Room 51 and The Ready Room 149. For more in-depth discussion about First Contact. But yeah, just great movie. I love the fact that it makes sense why Worf is in this movie, how he got there, the connection to DS9, not only in the fact that the Defiant is in the movie, and also, Matthew, when you go to the bridge of the Defiant at the beginning of the movie, it feels like Deep Space Nine.
Yes.
Which was wonderful.
And it really does. Yeah, the way it's shot. It feels like an episode of Deep Space Nine where the ship is in tatters and you're not sure if they're going to make it. It's awesome. Yeah.
It just visually, like, it felt like Deep Space Nine for those moments on the bridge, which was great. So.
Well, and did you notice, too, we didn't even talk about this, but that the lighting for the Enterprise kind of takes more of its cues from Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the lighting changed, even in Generations. You know, the lighting on the Enterprise changed.
It did.
Quite a lot from the TV series, thankfully.
It didn't look like a Walmart anymore. Really bright and really sterile.
That was Star Trek on television at the time. I mean, you know, Voyager's like that too.
True.
Everything is bright and kind of sanitized. So,
Anyway.
You have any final thoughts on Worf and First Contact?
Well, I have to say, I'm really loving doing this series with you, Chris. It's been so much fun because it's given us the opportunity to look back at these films and give me a new appreciation for some of them specifically. And I really have a new appreciation for First Contact and looking at it from Worf's point of view and what Deep Space Nine really did bring to the table. I see a lot of Deep Space Nine rubbing off on, you know, Ronald Moore and the writers here of First Contact. And I feel like they brought all that they were kind of doing on Deep Space Nine to the Next Generation crew, and it works great. It works really well. And if only they had kind of continued that trend in the rest of the films. But First Contact is hands down my favorite TNG film. I don't know how you can argue that it's not the best. It might not be your most sentimental favorite, because I know so for some people that's Generations and other things, and that makes complete sense. But yeah. I think objectively, this is the best film.
Yeah.
And I really can. This movie, Star Trek VI and Star Trek II, I can pop in at any time, anywhere, and I can watch them and just get the most enjoyment out of them possible. You know, the others I have to be in a mood for, but these, you know, even if they're on TV, I might stop and watch them. With commercials, so.
Don't you love how we do that as Star Trek fans? Like, we've seen every episode over and over, and we've seen every movie over and over, but no matter what we're doing, if we flip through the channels on the television and Star Trek's on, we'll stop and watch that, or at least let it play, even though we've got it on DVD on the shelf or whatever.
Yeah, it's funny.
It's kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah. Goodness! Justice is on! I've got to watch it!
I know! I've got to run through the flowers! Yeah, it's a good point about sentimental favorite, because for me, Generations probably is the sentimental favorite, but First Contact is my favorite and the best made. And I was watching it last weekend and just sitting here thinking, wow, this movie is just so well made. I mean, I can put First Contact on, just watch the opening credits, which are just names in blue coming on and coming into focus. But just that part with the music together is just amazing. So I love that. Well, let us know what you think about First Contact and Worf and DS9 Connections. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what we talked about today. The best place to do that is, of course, in the Babel Conference on Facebook. So Matthew, tell everyone how they can get there.
Well, best way to do that, Chris, is go to Facebook and type in Babel into the search field. That'll bring you to our listeners-only discussion group. Now, it is a private group, so you have to ask to be let in. We'll let you in, and you can join in the conversation of all the different things that we're talking about all throughout Star Trek and beyond, and beyond, beyond.
Beyond? Like
the 602 Club. Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Chris.
I haven't done that in a while.
And it feels good. It feels really good to hear again. I'm glad you brought it back. It's a great place to just be able to hang out with the fans of Trek FM and talk about all the things we're talking about on our shows. So come on over and join us. We'd really love you to be a part of that conversation.
Absolutely. So again, type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right on up. Now, if you're not on Facebook, I know not everyone is over there. You can, of course, find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. You can go to our website, trek.fm/contact, and use the form that you find there. And just choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that'll come to both Matthew and me by email. Or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm to leave a voicemail. That's the word speak and the word pipe together, .com/trekfm. And all you need is your phone or your tablet or your computer to record a message and upload it from the page. It's really easy, and there are no phone charges involved in that, which is nice. Well, continuing our discussion of Worf has been wonderful, but it's just one of the many things that we've been talking about on the network over the past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
The Wadi, a fun-loving race from the Gamma Quadrant, arrive at DS9 eager to play a game with Sisko and the crew, one that appears to be a matter of life and death. All right, so are we moving along, Matthew?
Oh, we're moving along.
The ready room.
He's carrying in the lamb chop sock puppet saying, she stayed at her post.
While Charlie Horse ran.
While Charlie Horse ran.
To the journey!
My last one, I think I might get a little bit of grief from you. Workforce, part one.
Oh my god.
I know. Hey, I did not make fun of Fairhaven.
That's because Fairhaven's good and Workforce is boring.
Oh, bite me.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
You know, you come up with something stupid because of some joke that someone said and someone else said, and then all of a sudden you're doing a tournament of movies which J.J. Abrams produced to determine which one is the crappiest.
The 602 Club.
We start getting hints of Thor, we start getting hints of Cap, we start getting hints of the entire Avengers crew, and we get Black Widow. So, I mean, Iron Man 2, considering how maybe that's not my favorite movie of the MCU, really does set up a lot of what is to come.
Literary Treks.
You know, visually, to me, this is one of my favorite eras of Star Trek. You know, those monster maroon coats they're wearing, and they're just absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, a lot of people talked about wanting to get a Captain Sulu Star Trek series, and one of the big reasons for me that that would be so great is to see this era played out visually on a regular basis.
Women at Warp.
Her voice as a computer voice has become so iconic that when Google started developing what is now known as Google Now, that personal assistant you can speak to, they had initially codenamed it Google Majel.
That's so cool.
Isn't that awesome?
Meta Treks.
And I kind of had the jingle in my head, you can be a winner at the game of life. And I was trying to think of the Star Trek version of that. You know, you can be a winner of the poker game of life on the Enterprise. It didn't really roll off the tongue, so.
It was great until you added on the Enterprise.
Melodic Treks.
The reason why I think Brian Reitzel would be a more plausible choice is because he has worked with Fuller in the past. They worked together on Hannibal. He scored that series, all 39 episodes. The neat thing about Brian Reitzel's music is it's more of a sound design than it is a score.
Saturday Morning Trek.
One of the characters is sizably larger than the other. So
he's just closer to the camera, Aaron, obviously.
But he's actually behind the other person.
He's a giant.
Wait, then he doesn't need a laser cutter. He can just lift the hatch up with it. Go down and get it.
Okay. Continuing mission.
Yeah, and of course, another great thing is when it's all finished and you look at it and go, yeah, we made that together. Yeah, that's one of the greatest moments. And people respond to it and say, oh, that's pretty well made. The effects are great. The actors are great, even though they're Dutch trying to speak English, right?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. And don't forget about our 50th anniversary rewatch show, which is going on right now as well. We're currently in the middle of season one of the original series, having already done all of Enterprise. So hop in there. We're doing two installments of Star Trek every single day this year. It is a leap year, so that's 366 days. And by the end, we will have covered everything in Star Trek, including the new movie when it comes out. So check out all of those. You can find our shows everywhere you get your podcasts, in iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. Go to the website, stream from the show pages, download the MP3 files, or get the RSS link. You can find us pretty much everywhere. Just search for Trek.fm and everything will come right on up. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our associate producers here on The Orb, Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, and Ken Tripp. Thank you so much to them for helping us keep the show coming out to you guys all the time. It takes a lot of work by many, many people to get this show and all of our other shows out. That includes all the hosts. It includes our associate producers. It includes our production manager, you know, Richard Marquez. We have so many people working behind the scenes all the time, and we really appreciate everybody's support. And if you would like to help out as well, you can go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to find out how you can become involved in the network. You can become an associate producer yourself. You can get on mic and talk about Star Trek with us on the Patrons Roundtable, or you can even become involved in other ways. All the information that you need is there at patreon.com/trekfm, including the perks and how you can get access to our exclusive website, Patron Zone, as well, that has early releases and wallpapers and avatars and ringtones and all kinds of other stuff that we throw out there for you from time to time. And that's available all the time to our patrons. So we thank everyone for your support of the network and helping us keep this all going. Now, Matthew, when you're not, you know, sitting back admiring that new uniform that Starfleet has dressed you up in, where can people find you?
So hard not to, Chris. I mean, I look so much better than those pajamas I felt like I was in. You can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I'm on Instagram at MRushing. I'm probably taking pictures of this uniform. You can also find me on Literary Treks, where I'm with Dan talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek. We're interviewing the authors. Please check us out. We have so much fun over there. You can also find me on the 602 Club, where we talk about a great new geeky topic each week. It's not Star Trek related. It's our place to kind of kick back and talk about all the other fandoms we love here on the network. I hope you'll join us. And I do a podcast with my friend John Mills called Aggressive Negotiations. And just, you can find us on iTunes, so check that out as well. Chris, when you are not trying to figure out whether or not to ram the Defiant into that Borg cube or run away, where can we find you?
Well, I'm preparing for 1/4 ramming speed. Just picturing that. I see the Starfleet manual for that and everything, so... Now, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. You can also find me in the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's also my username on Facebook in general. And also, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing The Ready Room, where we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series, as well as some Star Trek news. And you can find me doing Hyper Channel, which I do every day right now. It's our very short news show. It's usually about 8 to 10 minutes long. And I just talk about one story from the world of Star Trek and share my thoughts on it. And then you can also find my writing over on the official website at StarTrek.com. So check out all of those things out if you want more of my thoughts on the world of Star Trek.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.